Welcome to The Lob, your home of in-depth coverage and analysis by These Football Times, a movement of journalism you can trust. Each week, we endeavour to bring you the very best coverage of the game, exploring stories from the past and present with analysis by expert guests from around the world. Find more of our award-winning content online and in print. In the meantime, enjoy the podcast.
Hello and welcome to another edition of the Lob podcast with These Football Times. My name is Stuart Horsfield, and today we bring you episode one of a brand new series. This is South America Files, The Cities. And I'm going to first of all introduce my two co-hosts for this particular series, but I really should introduce the brains again, the series architect, the curator. Well, I can give him loads of names, to be fair, and I'm sure I'll keep adding to them as we go through the series. And we also have a special guest for this series who I'm pretty sure you will... Well, first of all, you'll hope it's this person based on what myself and the two co-hosts know about South American football. So you'll certainly be hoping that the special guest that we've got lined up for this series is who you want it to be. But before we get into all of that, let me just introduce you to Gary Thacker, who is the brains, like I say, behind this series. Gary, welcome. New series, always an exciting time. But like, as we record this, it's the first day back at school, colleges, after lockdown. And this feels like a first day at school for us.
Oh, I'll tell you what, that is some link there, Steve. That's some link, professional or what?
Thank you.
Yeah, when you were saying about the brains and the series, I thought you meant to our guest. You didn't mean me for a start.
Just creating
the
idea.
We did South America Files, the Countries, and it was such a popular series that, you know, and South America is such a hotbed of football. And when you started looking, you know, on a tighter focus within each country and some of the cities involved, the clubs involved there, it was just, you know, too good an opportunity to miss. And when we were sort of running past our resident South American football expert, and he agreed to come on. I mean, that was all the boxes were ticked and couldn't be ignored. So yeah, we've got we're going to be running around South America now for 14 episodes. We're going to do 7. And then we'll have a break and then come back and do another 7. So almost every major city in South America where there's football clubs, we'll be talking about. It's another great opportunity to learn to do, as you say. School day starts today. It's for South America Files.
Yeah, you see, people are apprehensive about going back to school, but not us. Not us. Although, unfortunately, we're still doing it on screens. But other than that, we're quite happy to be back at school.
Yeah, I've got to ask something. I'm going to be talking about football, aren't I?
I've got tea this time. I've got tea because I was back at school today and my throat is killing just from talking. So I've got tea tonight.
Gotcha.
Second co-host on our sojourn around South America is Mr. Stephen Scragg. Stephen, welcome. New series, school day.
Oh, always good when we're kicking off a new series.
Were you early to bed last night, hair wash and everything ready for tonight?
I was too excited. It was like Christmas Eve. Too excited to sleep.
But looking forward to this though, right?
Very much so, very much so. An absolute ball doing the nations. To pick through some of the cities and to kind of like put that focus on, you know, various cities is just going to be a huge amount of fun and a great deal of learning as well.
Yeah, there'll be a great deal of learning of that, there is no doubt. And I suppose we should then go, now the pupils are all in place, we better go and find the teacher. And I'm sure you'll all be pleased to know that throughout this series, along with Gary and Stephen and I, we are going to be led with our, as Gary said, our resident South American football expert. It's Dr. Pete. Pete, welcome back.
How are you doing, guys? Good to see you again.
Excellent. And are you looking forward to, well, I want to say, really, you're just taking us round South America again and educating us and just generally ensuring we don't get lost, pretty much.
Yeah, no, I mean, I'm going to be, you know, like checking that you guys have done your homework, you know, making sure you're looking smart, making sure you're not bullying the kind of the guy that, you know, has to ask a few more questions. So we're going to have, you know, good behaviour throughout, try and keep an orderly classroom and, yeah, I mean, you know, who knows, even, you know, try and learn something. But I mean, you know, as a former teacher myself, bit of a, you know, as a lecturer, you know, I don't mind having a bit of a laugh as well. So there'll probably be a bit of mischief having in the middle of the lessons as well, I think.
Brilliant. All right. So the gang's all here. Episode now, obviously as well, I've had to practice my South American pronunciations. So episode, when we go to Rio, it'll be fine. But for now, obviously for this one, in Asunción in Paraguay, is that right, Pete?
Absolutely spot on, Steve.
Thank you. Thank you very much. And thank you for the lesson before we started recording. I am very grateful. So that's where we're starting. So we're starting in Paraguay. I think if I remember correctly from when we chatted about Paraguay as a nation in the South America files, I certainly think Stephen and I were in agreement that this was the archetypal comic strip, South American sort of the how you imagine them to be when you're reading Roy of the Rovers and Melchester Rovers are playing against a South American team. You imagine Paraguay, you imagine a team coming from there. But like I say, it's a particular city. So I guess, first of all, then, major clubs in the city.
Okay, I mean, so in Paraguay, pretty much all the main clubs come from Asunción. One of the kind of features of South American football, I suppose most generally, is that the capitals really do dominate. There's very few countries where you don't see, you know, the teams from the capital dominating. And I think when we eventually come to somewhere like Colombia, that'll be different. You know, Colombia is one of the few countries that will have, you know, various different seats of power. But, you know, and there are some countries that will have two competing cities which have that rivalry. Paraguay isn't really like that. Almost every major club and almost every single title throughout the Paraguayan league history will come from the capital city. The kind of main clubs, I guess, really there are five, you know, in no particular order, without wishing to kind of irritate our kind of Paraguayan listeners or any kind of Paraguayan football fans. We'll kind of go in a vague order of creation. So Olimpia were the first club created in 1902. Then there's a little bit of dispute. Guarani will claim to be the second club founded in 1903, although there was recent evidence to say that actually they were founded 2 years after that. Nacional claim to be either second or third. You know, I mean, it's amazing that South American fans can find so many things to argue about, you know, like dates of foundation and something else. But Nacional were founded in 1904. Then you have Libertad, which means freedom. They were founded in 1905. And then I suppose the other one of the big five is Cerro Porteño, founded a little bit later than the others in 1912. There are a couple of other clubs that are worth mentioning. I'm going to bring up the brilliantly named club, named after one of the few clubs that's named after an American president, which is Presidente Hayes, President Hayes, which is named after the President Rutherford B. Hayes, a pretty much, you know, irrelevant US president, 19th president of the USA, but is one of the great heroes of Paraguayan history because he arbitrated the kind of Argentine-Paraguayan territorial dispute at the end of the War of the Triple Alliance and ruled in Paraguay's favor. So all around Paraguay, there are various roads and so on that are named after Rutherford B. Hayes. And actually, he gave his name to a football club as well. And they actually have won the league once as well in something like 1952, although they're now kind of in Division 3 or something. So it's worth giving them a little mention. You could also mention Sol de America. It's a little bit difficult whether we count them. They were originally founded in the Barrio Obrero in 1909, which is the same barrio that Nacional and I think Cerro Porteño also founded in. But actually, they play a lot of their games in Villa Elisa, which is kind of a border town. It's kind of one of those satellite towns. It's on the edge of Asunción. So, you know, we could count them, I suppose. And there are various other little clubs that have some kind of sense of impact here and there. We could mention Atlantita, one of the early teams in the Paraguayan League, who had a little bit of success in the 1910s. Tacuari were a club that rose out of nowhere really to qualify for the Libertadores in 2005 and 2007. But really, when we're talking about Asunción, we're talking about the big five, and particularly really the big two, Olimpia and Cerro Porteño, who really dominate the fandom in Asunción. The other clubs have had a considerable amount of success. You know, they've won leagues, they've done well here and there in Europe, in Latin America, they've got to the Copa Libertadores a few times. But really, in terms of international reputation, in terms of history, in terms of, I suppose, fame, then Olimpia and Cerro Porteño are the two that really dominate.
Okay, that's not a bad start, Gary, to get us up on our... I've already learned about 99.9% more than I already knew. Yeah. But I suppose, you know, in all seriousness, though, you know, sort of Pete mentions there quite early on how, you know, in South American countries, you know, there's high levels of geographical concentration with regards to its football teams. And it's something that, I'm not saying we struggle with, but it would seem, you know, to us, if, you know, it's the equivalent of clubs being just based purely in London, Birmingham, Liverpool, because Stevens on not Manchester, and Newcastle, you know. So, you know, it's almost like it's almost that environment which, you know, which I suppose is quite alien for us to sort of comprehend, I guess.
That's the thing with recurring theme, as you said, when we did the South American countries. And, you know, I mean, that was a fantastic introduction there by Pete. Just sort of taking on board what he said about Presidente Hayes. I mean, can you imagine a club being called Prime Minister Cameron? Or God forsake PM Thatcher. I mean, I mean anybody you support them would be outlandish.
I mean, Atletico Thatcher has a great ring to it.
non-sporting Thatcher probably a bit more appropriate politically. But yeah, so it's fascinating, and you know, I did a little bit of research myself, and Fonsi Ernie is one of the most difficult ones we're going to look at over the coming weeks to sort of swat up on. But one thing I did notice, and Pete mentioned about Olimpia and Cerro Porteño, they've won more than half between them of the total Paraguayan National League titles contested. So, I mean, that's a pretty dominant duopoly. I mean, I won't say it's on levels staked with Barcelona and Real Madrid or perhaps Celtic and Rangers Scotland, but that's pretty dominant, isn't it?
It is, and I guess this is, you know, something that I was going to ask you, Stephen, and that's, I suppose, how this impacts on fans, you know, in terms of when clubs are so tightly geographically located, you know, obviously, you know, there will be people who live further away. Do you think, and I'm not asking for a definite answer, by the way, I don't need you to be a South American expert on this question, but do you think, you know, it's why South American football struggles to progress and stuff, because, you know, obviously it doesn't, it's very much a football powerhouse, but in terms of the game developing, that must bring its own issues.
Yeah, because it's all so parochial, you know, it's all on the doorstep, you know, all your rivals surround you, you know, you're not travelling, you know, any huge distance to another big city or towns or anything like that. So, you know, it's somewhat unrecognisable to what we're used to, you know, as a travelling fan of an English club, you know, you get used to the different quirks of personality around the country because you get to know supporters of various clubs. So, yeah, and, you know, it's a country, you know, of kind of like rich diversity, really, you know, that we don't really give it the credit for. So yes, you know, when you're talking about a city that is the hub of a football nation, you know, it has to bring it home a whole lot more, quite literally, because it is on your doorstep. You know, so many other countries will have, you know, it's like Brazil with the, you know, the Rio State Championship and all of that, you know, it was all kept very, very local for good reason, you know, geographical reasons. So yes, you know, to have your biggest rivals there on your doorstep, we're just used to having, you know, a big rival that you have your derby against. Maybe there's an arch enemy, because every team has a, you know, that Dick Dastardly, you know, over the shoulder, you know, usually about 30 miles away, you know, give or take. You know, I'd probably say towards the east mostly. know, from a Liverpool perspective, that's where Dick Dastardly lives. So, you know, this is what you've got. You know, all of your Dick Dastardlys and your penalty pit stops are on your doorstep.
Are you just saying football in Paraguay and Asuncion is like wacky races? Is that?
I am going a bit Hanna-Barbera here, and yes, there is a touch. And I suppose if we pick through all the clubs, we could probably allot, you know,
The Antil mob will be there somewhere.
The Antil mob will be in there, as will be the Red Baron, you know, the Crimson Hay Baler, you know, the Slag Brothers, and all of those. You know.
Brilliant. You
know, I can already hear the theme tune, churning.
Okay. So bearing that in mind, Pete, that we've now likened this football to a Hanna-Barbera episode. But in all seriousness then, I guess, you know, in terms of sort of the foundation of these clubs, because, you know, it always fascinates me that, you know, Olympia, say, was in 1902. The next one was in 1903, maybe four or five, as depending on which history you believe. You know, first of all, who do Olympia play for a year? But beyond all of that, you know, sort of the history of these clubs as they're establishing, you know, do these clubs, you know, are they sort of generated by class or by politics? You know, how do they sort of form? And is there a sociological forming of these clubs?
Yeah. I was going to say that carrying on the wacky racist thing, some of the kind of nefarious practices of Dick Dastardly probably happened in Paraguayan football as well. But you know, actually answering your question, I mean, it's Paraguay is a really interesting case. I mean, because I think as we talked about in the Nation series, it's a Dutchman that is the founding father, a guy called Willem Putz. And he is really responsible for the football that's played. You know, he starts introducing football into the schools. And that's where the football really, really happens. You know, that's where it starts from. That's where the club emerges. And, you know, so the first football that's being played is being played, you know, at William Patz's school. You know, the kind of club Olympia is founded around that. But then Guarani, who, you know, claimed to be the second one, it seems that there are other boys who are, you know, involved with a different school, or other young Paraguayans who are at a different school, or, you know, want to play. They want to join in. They want to borrow the ball that is being played with on the fields of where Olympia is starting. And apparently, you know, they wouldn't give them the ball, so they nicked it. You know, which is a very, you know, adult, very typical thing of South American to do. Very wacky race, in fact. You know, nick someone else's ball and run off so they can't play. So these kids run off with the ball, and apparently Willem Pat sets the police on them. And what happens is that they're eventually caught by a former president of Paraguay, General Bernardino Caballero, apparently happened to be there and said, look, you can't arrest them just for wanting to play football and nicking a ball. And then actually kind of sponsors them to help set up their club, to kind of have this rival club. And it seems that, you know, this is what they did. And they called themselves Guarani because they wanted to kind of go on a very national type of idea, as opposed to Olympia, which was all about kind of, I suppose, international ideals of sportsmanship and modernity and harking back to Olympian traditions of what sport was for. I think that these kids, or these young people at Guarani, wanted to kind of find something a little bit more Paraguayan. And that's the similar case with Nacional as well, one of the next teams. Again, this is a team that, you know, named themselves after the nation, after, you know, in order of Paraguay. So I guess that, you know, we're still looking at, you know, the upper echelons of society that are forming these clubs. There is official patronage from, you know, former presidents, from influential leaders, you know, from families who have the money, you know, to you know, educate their kids and send them to decent schools. We also have some political influence. I think that, you know, Paraguay is a country that, if we say it very generously, that their political transitions have been somewhat fraught quite regularly, then we're probably understating it. But the period of when all these clubs are being founded is quite a tumultuous one. You know, it's a period where there is a kind of eternal fight between the Liberals and the Colorados for political power. And actually some of the clubs are founded in a kind of spirit of trying to establish some kind of, you know, middle ground, to try and find some kind of political fraternity, I suppose. And Cerro Porteño are the best example of that. You know, they are founded, you know, with young people that are of both political persuasions. And they take as their colours blue and red, the two colours of the Liberals and the Colorados, in order to kind of have this sense of national unity. Libertad are actually similar. Libertad was formed by a group of Liberals who arrived in the city in, I think it was 1905, and took over power. And in the general ideas of, you know, what do we want to do with this new situation, they decided to form a football club. This was born out of an urge of creation and what should we do to try and develop the nation a little bit. And again, they, you know, very symbolically, Libertad overthrowing the Colorados, but also it was the name of the boat. They happened to travel down the river into Asunción. So I guess you've got lots of different founding interests. You know, you maybe at this stage don't have as many of the, I suppose, of the working class being really involved in the foundation of these clubs. You don't have teams like you do in Argentina, for example, which emerge from factories just yet. They're kind of a little bit more official, a little bit more elitist. And then I suppose because Asunción is not one of the bigger South American cities, and particularly, you know, with the wars that it suffered in the Triple Alliance and then a little bit later with the Chaco, you know, we're not talking about huge amounts of population, and we're not talking about, you know, I suppose, lots of different options. You know, you know, the people in that city are seeing what's going on, will affiliate themselves with where they are. So I suppose there is a little bit of crossover with certain clubs. Cerro Porteño take on the mantle of being the most popular club, possibly with the idea, I suppose, that they are a little bit late to the game and are seen as being the ones that are challenging, I suppose, the first football teams that have really established themselves. So there are various lots of different influences between classes, between you know, different aspects of society, different political parties.
Sorry, I mean, you know, Gary, that's, I suppose, you know, in some respects, you know, we talked about how, you know, how difficult it was to sort of comprehend this tight geographical sort of location and, you know, and these football clubs. But I guess what is, I suppose what is, not so much reassuring, but it's more recognisable to us, and that, you know, and that is that football clubs are formed under certain, you know, conditions that are influenced by what goes on in society. And then those very early established sort of means and ethos, if you like, then continues through, and there's almost that reassurance that actually that is recognizable, that is something we can, you know, that football fans around the world can relate to, that clubs are born out of situations, you know, they're born out by, you know, whatever it is that the people who happen to live there are living under, working under, the opportunities that arise. But then once they're in place, they then become the established norm.
Yeah, the sort of stories Peter just related there, they tend to be, I guess, born from an identity or from an aspiration. I was expecting, and there again, you know, this is one of the reasons why this is such a great episode for the three of us, the great season for the three of us, as much as anybody listening, is you learn so much. And, you know, I was expecting that at least some, if not the majority of the clubs, would have a European influence in their foundation, with European bringing football to South America. Which was a sort of fairly common theme when we were going through the Nations series. But from what Peter just said, that doesn't seem to be the case, or certainly not overwhelmingly the case. And there seems to be a lot more of a Paraguayan factor in the creation of the clubs, which I'll say is not what I expected, but this is why, you know, this series is so great, because I've learned something else already.
It is, and I suppose, you know, following on from that question, and this seems to be working really nicely at the moment. So following on from that, Stephen, do you think that gives more authenticity to these clubs and to arguably to Paraguayan football as, you know, as a whole, the fact that, you know, as Gary's mentioned there, and as Pete said, you know, they're born from almost internal influence rather than external influence?
Yes, they are, because you know, I think as we discussed in the Nations one, you know, Paraguay was, you know, if at all, kind of like one of the later ones to be plundered of its natural resources by, you know, the big bad Europeans who come over and plunder whatever it is that they can give. So, you know, yes, there is something authentically Paraguayan about this. Whereas, you know, we look at other nations and other cities that we'll come to where, you know, the inspiration is very much looking to, whether that's Brazil and the Corinthian ideals or, you know, and all of that, you know, there is that aspect that, you know, the inspiration is, if not British, then European. But, you know, this is very different. You know, Paraguay and Asuncion is very, very different. I mean, even when you come to look at some of the small clubs, I found a great fascination when I found a great kind of like link to some of the smaller clubs of the city. And, you know, some of them just had great stories behind them. You know, Deportivo Pinoza, you know, properly ramshackle stadium where there's only kind of like 80 allowed in because it's such in such state of disrepair. You know, there were the self-crowned champions of the very first third division. You know, as if they didn't have any competitors, we will pronounce ourselves as champions. It was such a wonderful team to find out about. You know, Resistencia, another one. You know, these were you know, a club that's defied the odds because they're at low level and constantly get the ground flooded. You know, there's property developers that want the club to die so they can just have the land, but they don't. They keep on coming back for more. You know, there's a great ideology. You know, if you look for a working class club, this is the one in the city. You know, the port workers that kind of like, you know, were the people who kind of like made this club grow. You know, trade unionists, and you know, there's a great, you know, he's kind of sold as a bit of an anarchist, and there's an argument over whether this is true or not. You know, Sandalio Riveros, you know, who is seen as this almost kind of like a Father Christmas kind of effect. You know, is it a myth? Is it true? You know, some will say that he was just a, you know, a bureaucrat, and others are saying no, he's a political anarchist. So there's this great kind of, you know, I don't know, spirit to the club. So there's so many, you know, Club Rubio New, another one, you know, playing green and white, you know, colours that represent, was it purity and hope? You know, it's great, these stories that tip up and you know, Silvio Petriossi, you know, club, you know, the Aviators, you know, the named after a, you know, a great aviation kind of like, you know, genius. So, you know, it's so many of these clubs that tip up, and it's not just about the big clubs either. Yet, what's the running theme through this is when I look to certain cities, I mean, especially Europe, when you look at certain cities and think, you know, if I was living in that city, where would I be drawn to? You know, you look at some clubs and think that I wouldn't touch you with a barge pole because, you know, you're completely against, you know, my view on life, you know. And I think the thing with Asuncion is that you find it very, very difficult to find a club to dislike. You know, there is no serious bad guy here. You know, yes, you can look at Olympia as being the most successful, the team that has translated into continental success and all of that, you know, a team to be envied maybe. But, you know, they're certainly not coming across to me as a particularly dislikable football club. You know, and it's the way that they all kind of, I mean, they do have those classic kind of like, you know, you could suggest they were the upper class club maybe, but not massively, you know. And yeah, all of this, you know, it just makes for what seems to be a really fascinating mixture of clubs and an environment that is proudly Paraguayan, I think.
It's a great answer to the question, which actually, I'm going to ask you another one, Pete, on here that's wasn't actually originally a question, but is now I'm just interested in. So in Asuncion, is there a, you might not know this, but is there still a strong amateur sort of side to the game? Because obviously, you know, obviously a lot of the clubs are concentrated there, whether they're in, you know, the top division, you know, so there is this high concentration, but is there still room for a thriving amateur scene? Or is it, you know, does it sort of go from, you know, does it not have that, not middle tier, but, you know, obviously here you have the Football League and then you have what used to be the Conference North, Conference South, and, you know, it works its way down the tiers. But I suppose what I'm asking is, when football is concentrated like this and you have the professional clubs and there's such a high concentration, is there then a big gap between what we would just class as grassroots and that almost amateur level just disappears?
Yeah, I mean, it's difficult to know. I mean, I've never been to Asuncion, so I'm kind of going on what I've read and what I know, I suppose. I think the first thing in terms of the drop-off that you look between the size of clubs is in stadium size. You know, if we just kind of look at that as an indicator to start with, you know, we have Cerro Porteño, who have 45,000. Olimpia's stadium isn't actually that big, it's 25. But then there's a really big drop-off. You know, we're going down to, you know, maybe 10 and even down to 5. I mean, going back to President Hayes again, you know, my kind of the team I'm most fascinated by. I mean, they've got a ground that's slightly bigger than Guarani's. And Guarani are a team that regularly get to the Copa Libertadores. I think that what you do have, in terms of, I suppose, an amateur tradition, and a little bit of what Steve was talking about, I guess, and it's something that I think we'll probably revisit when we talk about Chile and when we talk about Argentina as well, is that you have a real tradition of barrio football, you know, of neighbourhood football, of places that were very close, were very compact, were very linked. And that may well be because of factories, it might be to do with docks, it might be to do with, you know, political ideals, it might be, you know, it might just be that they were based around, you know, the pub and the social club where they went. But you, or in South America, often these clubs are very linked around, they're very tied to the social area where they are, the street, the barrio, and the club that symbolizes that. And I think that's where, you know, that kind of amateur tradition and those kind of identities that Steve would talk about can really be found. And a lot of those clubs will still be there, and they will go back to a club that was founded in the 1910s, 1920s, maybe got decimated in terms of its members during the Chaco War, but somehow survived and somehow kept going. I think that also part of this is tied to a Paraguayan identity more widely. You know, when we talked about Paraguay as a nation, it's got this real sense of the fighting spirit, you know, the people who will never give up, who are almost the continental underdogs. You know, somehow they survived, you know, being wiped out in the Triple Alliance War. You know, they found a way to survive in the Chaco. There is something very Paraguayan that battles. And I think that can be found in the local clubs as well as some of the bigger ones. I think that, therefore, you know, there is a drop off, I think, certainly between the very big clubs and the very small ones, and it happens very quickly. That's probably indicative in the domination of Asuncion. And the fact that some of the neighbouring cities like Luque haven't really contributed a huge amount. I think if you go outside of the country, you find a lot of the amateur football. I think that's where that amateur tradition is found. You know, there are kind of regional rural leagues, which is probably very, you know, very amateurish, very hardy, probably not played with on pitches with very much grass. But it'll be there, it'll be going on. And I think it's every 2 years there is a kind of a championship where the kind of champions of different rural leagues will then compete to try and go into, you know, I suppose one of the more national leagues. So I think that that's, you know, so I think there is lots of different types of amateurish football linked to, you know, the finances and, you know, where it's played, but also due to kind of the pride of identities, the, you know, the very localized linkages between, you know, lifestyle, between neighborhood, between workplace, and, you know, and finding somewhere to play football and keep that tradition going.
It's a great point. Like I say, I know it's not something we were sort of talking about, but it's, or we plan to talk about, but I might ask you that question in every episode, because I just think the more football has sort of grown and, you know, become this huge, certainly in this country, this huge sort of capitalist corporate event, you know, sort of semi-professional football, amateur football seems to be where you can find, again, I hate to keep using the word, but where you find the most authentic football, or the sort of game that, you know, you remember or I remember sort of growing up. So I guess I'm interested in how that translates in a different continent, whether that's still the same or whether it's a different, you know, it's a completely different beast there. But, you know, that I like the answer. In terms of the clubs then that do exist, obviously there, Pete, you know, you mentioned very briefly at the beginning about, you know, clubs that dominate, you know, the two clubs that have dominated the championship. You'd sort of mentioned a little bit about Copa Libertadores' success. But in terms of, I suppose, making a name for themselves nationally, but then for me, more importantly, making themselves continentally. You know, which of these sides can probably lay claim to being the most successful?
I mean, that's without doubt Olimpia. And at the moment, every single Cerro Porteño fan is angry, but it's really true. I mean, Olimpia have won 45 championships. Cerro Porteño have won 32. There's actually quite a big drop off there. And Libertad have got 20 titles. A lot of those have come in this century, actually. Libertad, to some extent, have been the most successful club of this particular century, which is quite something. Then Guarani and Nacional, we've got 11 and 9, and then there's a real drop-off after that. I mean, Olimpia stand out because they have done it continentally. You know, they've won three Libertadores Cups, the real judgment of a club's prestige in the continent. They've been runners-up in four times, on four different occasions. I think there's only five or six clubs who've won it more. And interestingly, none of those are Brazilian. You know, I think that Olimpia are a more successful club. I think I might be wrong there in terms of victories to the Libertadores and any Brazilian clubs. So that says something. Olimpia are also really important for Paraguay because they broke the hegemony of Uruguay, of Argentina and Brazil. You know, previously the Libertadores and continental fame, you know, and prestige of when you think about South American club football, you didn't think about anyone other than Peñarol, Nacional, you know, Santos, Boca Juniors, River, Racing, you know, you think of those clubs. You don't think of anyone else. And Olimpia, when they first managed to, you know, to win the Libertadores in 79, it was a breakthrough moment. And it was a Paraguayan club that did that. You know, it was a huge moment of saying, right, Paraguay have the best club in the continent. We have a club that compete with these names and can beat them. So they did take on, you know, huge national importance. That was a kind of a moment where that kind of stranglehold of the big three was broken. And that, you know, they've gone on to do it since. They had a very successful couple of years from 1989-1991 when they got to the final three occasions, lost it twice, won it in the middle. That was, you know, a major moment. Cerro Porteño have been, I suppose, the nearly club. You know, they're the club that, you know, frequently get to the kind of the quarterfinals, the semi-finals, and then don't quite make that final leap. And that, you know, of course, every Olimpia fan will happily rub that into the Cerro Porteño fans, you know, every time the Libertadores comes along. You know, I mean, it's a fact. But, you know, but Olimpia certainly dominate both nationally and on the continental level as well. And also they've had the success in the intercontinental, you know, club that a lot of Europeans kind of don't really value, but South Americans do a lot more because it is upturning the putting one in the eye of the European powerhouses and showing that, you know, South America is a footballing stronghold as well.
So here's a question for you, Gary. I might have asked you this before. No. So if we take Asuncion as our example, as we are tonight, the continental success. So, you know, based on obviously what Pete said about the geography of sides and this concentration of sides, but where do you stand on clubs from, imagine you are an Asuncionian, because I'm sure that's what they're called, people who are from there. And if you're a supporter of another club, but there's a club doing well in the Copa Libertadores, are you supporting that club because they are from your country and they are representing even your city on a continental stage, or because they are your rivals, you don't want them to do well?
Well, I suppose it'd be a bit like asking Lit Stevie if he'd be supporting Everton if they were playing in the Champions League final, or an Arsenal, perhaps a better example, an Arsenal fan if they'd support Spurs if they were playing in the Champions League final. I mean, the answer to that would be probably somewhat doubtful. It may be different in Asuncion, because I guess with so many clubs, the rivalry might get a little bit diluted. Although, as Pete mentioned, he sort of referred to the rivalry between Olimpia fans and Cerro Porteño fans. And I guess that's probably the big derby, the big rivalry in Asuncion. And I think if one of those teams were playing, the others would perhaps be hoping any team, but their rivals would win. It's an interesting question. And I guess there might be some mitigation, you know, when they're seen to be playing the powerhouse of South America. It's fascinating. I didn't know this, but Pete mentioned about Olimpia have won more Copa del Libertadores titles than any Brazilian club. I mean, you know, even if that's not exactly true and it's just close, it's still pretty stunning. Because, you know, obviously the size of Paraguay and the, you know, compared to, the, you know, the perceived big guns in South America of Argentina and Brazil, that's amazing fact. But, I think it would be difficult, I think, is the honest answer, Stu, to support your rivals. If Tottenham were playing, we don't have really local rivals, it would be difficult. I'll refer to the missus. Mrs. of Wolves fan, and if the West Bromwich Albion were playing in the final of anything, she wanted the other team to win, even if it was the adult people at 11. So you know, I think, you know, rivalries do overcome some things.
I guess we'll come to you then with that one then, Stephen, in terms of, you know, where you sit with, I suppose, City rivals. Are they ever, you know, are they ever put aside? And I guess it's difficult because, you know, as we've sort of mentioned here, you know, when you have this high concentration, you know, and you talked about sort of the, you know, the big derby and the Dick Dastardly opponent that you have. And I guess, you know, that not everyone can, not even though it's a high concentration in this city, not everyone can be that bitter rival. So, you know, I get that it's a difficult question to ask, but can you sort of overcome? So, you know, I don't know. If it was Tranmere Rovers, then let's say. So we've got Liverpool, Everton, and Tranmere Rovers. You know, how are you feeling about Tranmere Rovers sort of doing well in the Champions League or whatever? You know, is it any other club from your city, or is it just a certain club from your city?
Well, for me, it's different because I think it just depends on your grounding and your upbringing. You know, how were you? You know, introduce the football. You know, what, you know, were you given the kind of like, we hate that team over there? You know, whereas for me, I was never kind of like given that grounded. You know, when I was a kid, Everton, it's got to sound like I'm slagging them off now, but Everton were quite insignificant when I was a kid and at that early dawning of realization about football. You know, Aston Villa and Nottingham Forest were actually, you know, Liverpool's biggest rivals when I first switched on to football. So, you know, they weren't really, they were there, but they weren't really kind of like a consideration as such. It was only kind of like the mid-80s when it suddenly kicked in that, oh, hang on a minute, they can actually do stuff. So, you know, for me, I was never given that kind of like upbringing to hate, you know, the opposition. I've always said with Everton, for me, is that if Liverpool can be guaranteed winning the Champions League and the Premier League, I'll happily see them win the FA Cup and the League Cup. Now, I'm happy for them to be successful as long as it's less successful than my team. Now, as long as that's all right and we're all understood on that, then that's great. You know, we can all get along. And I'm sending that out to Paul McParland. I'm thinking of you, Paul. In answer to the question, it just depends, you know, what you were brought up, though. Do you conform to the, you know, to the pantomime of football, or, you know, is your, you know, the love of your own club, you know, stronger than your hate of the opposition?
It's a fair way to answer, a very fair way to answer. I'm sure Paul's now switched off. I think he switched off when you said that you saw them as insignificant. I don't even think he got to the end of your answer, to be honest. You know, obviously, you know, you mentioned, Pete, you know, right from the beginning that, you know, Olimpia are sort of the, I suppose, the premier club here. And I guess, do you think that's ever going to change? And again, I know it's a difficult question, you know, and football certainly goes in cycles and those sorts of things. But do you think certainly football in Paraguay, but in Asuncion is structured in such a way that, you know, is highly, highly likely to, or highly, highly unlikely, sorry, to change?
Yeah, I don't think it's going to change a huge amount. I don't think we're going to suddenly see, you know, teams from, you know, other cities really challenging a huge amount. I mean, the teams from Luque, you know, Sportivo Luqueño, have periods of success. I think it comes down to a little bit of money. One of the things that I think has you know, made a couple of clubs successful at certain times as their political sponsors or their financial sponsors. You know, the Olympia were very lucky to have a chap called Dominguez Dib, who was their sponsor during their great years. You know, he was someone that Umberto, sorry, his first, I'm trying to remember his first name, Osvaldo, that's right, Osvaldo Dominguez Dib. He was a guy that really revolutionized Paraguayan football by being that kind of the owner that put the money in and put the structures in place for Olympia to be successful. Similarly, Libertad at the start of the 21st century had a similar guy called Horacio Cartes who ended up being Paraguayan president for a few years. And again, these were two empresarios who had their money in cigarettes and farming and, you know, coke, various soft drinks and so on, and actually would put the money into, you know, finding the best players, you know, improving the structures around their clubs. So I think that that's what it really comes down to. I guess that in Paraguay, what you have really is that you have two things that count. You have the ability to find the best talent and the ability to train them. And then potentially you have the ability to sign them, what those young players for a bigger club before they go to either Argentina or Brazil or maybe Mexico, which seems to be the first three destinations of Paraguayan footballers, or potentially Europe. So that really counts. Randomly, there has been in the last kind of, I think, 15 years or so, we've seen certain clubs bringing in unusual foreign players. You know, Adebayor turned up randomly in Paraguay recently. You know, we had Jeremy Engetap, you know, of, I think, Chelsea and Real Madrid, you know, played in Paraguay. So there is a little bit of where the money is. They can try and get these players and so on. But really, you know, you've got certain clubs which have big stadiums that will get more money than, you know, others. I mean, you know, with Cerro Porteño with 45,000 are always going to get more money than Guarani, who have 5,000 in their stadiums. So I think that Olimpia are always going to be up there. You know, Libertad at the moment, because they've got that financial backing, will always be up there. You know, that's really what counts. And again, because you don't have these big injections of money from elsewhere, you don't have clubs with the, you know, the hierarchy. We always talk about this hierarchy in South American football. They don't have those, you know, the structures that you need. It's hard to see a club suddenly emerging phoenix-like from nowhere and suddenly becoming a giant. I think, you know, it hasn't happened since 1902, you know, in 119 years, and it doesn't really look like changing, you know, very much anytime soon, unfortunately.
And again, I guess, Gary, you know, you have to question that not so much the health of football in Asunción, but certainly whether or not that is a healthy environment for the game to develop.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I guess to a greater or lesser extent, the story of, you know, financial domination of football is repeated around the world. And hearing the size of the stadium that Olimpia have compared to, you know, aside from Cerro Porteño, the others, it's a sort of a fairly damning statistic when you think of finance and, you know, self-financing, shall we say. I mean, obviously, there's always the prospect of somebody coming in and putting oodles of brass into clubs, but I guess the internal finances of the system does preclude major developments of changes in the sort of the structure of the league, the hierarchy, as Pete described. There was a sort of fascinating fixture in Spain last week, which sort of argued slightly against it, and Ibar, who was a little town in the Basque Country, were playing in Huesca, who were from the north of Spain, Catalonia. And if you put the entire population of Ibar and Huesca into the Camp Nou with 110,000 capacity, you still have 30,000 seats empty. I mean, that's the size of these two towns combined. So, you know, and they're both playing in the top league. So, and Ibar have been doing so for the last, I don't know, 4 or 5 years. So, you know, it can change, but those things will only ever last for a short time, because finance will always the lovers win out in the end. It's sad, and I'm not saying it's nice, I'm just saying it's true.
Obviously, again, this is something I'm not saying we can't relate to, Stephen, or something that we struggle to relate to, but in terms of the psychology of this, then this situation, you know, not only for the clubs or the players, but I guess for the fans as well, you know. And again, you know, the great example that you use is sort of Everton, but then you look at what happened, certainly, you know, mid-80s, and although it wasn't sustained, it's still, you know, it was still there. But you know, but listening to, you know, and as we've said, you know, Premier League winners are dominant forces, you know, they have these cycles in this country. But, you know, you're looking at a city like Pete's saying there, and you wonder about the psychology of that for fans, the psychology of that for players, the psychology of that for club owners, and how that almost impenetrable dominance would make you feel.
Yes, I mean, I think football fans tend to be the great romantics. They always hold out hope that, you know, that success will come, that day will dawn. You know, Asuncion has had the instances of this. I mean, Club Nacional went 63 years without a league title. You know, they broke the spell in 2009, and then like 5 years later, they became the second Paraguayan club to reach a Copa Libertadores final, and they only narrowly lost out in that final to San Lorenzo. So, you know, when you see a team do something like that, you know, to have that return to prominence, to have that rise and say, well, look, they can do it, then, you know, my team can do it as well. And, you know, football tends to fuel itself on more hope than anything else, because the teams that succeed are just a small cartel, you know, basically. Whereas, you know, 98%, 97% of teams are generated through just the love of the support and that hope that at least that one success will fall their way.
It's, I guess, like I say, Pete, you know, it's whether this is a thread, you know, and it's going to be interesting as we go through this series about how these, you know, these things change as we go, maybe into the bigger countries, you know, once we go to Brazil and Argentina and stuff, and whether this these stories say the same, or whether, you know, some cities just have their own unique characteristics when it comes to football, and, you know, and certainly domestic football, and it's, you know, and how it operates, you know, its history, and how that sort of is now seen in, you know, in contemporary football within that city and within that country. But, you know, as Gary mentioned at the beginning, this was always going to be a, you know, sort of a steep learning curve for us, and, you know, and it has been, and, you know, we've learned so much already. But in terms of, you know, this city in Paraguay and this high concentration of clubs, where does it sit with the local derbies or the Dick Dastardlies, as they're now going to be forever called? So, you know, does one club seem to have more Dick Dastardlies than the others, or have they all shared out their Dick Dastardlies? Is it a nice even spread? Is it a very unrequited Dick Dastardly love affair? Do some people see one club and others don't? How does that sort of play out?
I love that idea. Yeah, it's like, oh, this week we get to hate them instead of them. Yeah, I think there are so many derbies, you know, and I think that they all have their own names. They all have a certain reason behind them. There. I think one of the other things about these derbies that there are myths and legends and famous occurrences, and, you know, the time that the referee sent three of our guys off, but we still won, or, you know, all those stories that go back and back, and those mutual hatreds, and you find a reason to hate them. And I think as well is that, you know, you've got, I mean, Cerro Porteño versus Olimpia is the big one, the kind of the classical, because, you know, they are the two biggest clubs. They're the teams that will, you know, will normally be competing, that have the big, you know, the biggest fan base. I mean, the Cerro Porteño are known as la mitad más uno, the half plus one, as in the half of the nation and one, because they have to be more than Olimpia, for example. I mean, then you've got the derby between Guarani and Olimpia, which is known as the Clásico Añejo. Añejo means the oldest one, because the very first match that was played in the first amateur league back in, I think, 1908, was it 1908? I can't remember the exact date, but that was between Guarani and an Olympia. So that is his heart. Harks back to the first one, and that will always be a sense of pride. Then you have the black and white derby, because you know the two teams involved there, Olimpia and Libertad, you know, will be playing in black and white. You have, you know, and I suppose the lesser games, you know, the games that don't necessarily feature Olimpia or Cerro Porteño, you know, the Guarani Libertad has a certain prestige. The Nacional versus Cerro Porteño is seen as being the game of the workers' district, for example, as well. So each game has its own kind of identity, its own importance. But I think really, you know, you look at the, in terms of pure numbers, in terms of passion, in terms of the one that the most people are going to be at, and it's going to be the Cerro Porteño Olimpia. And that's where the Defensores del Chaco, which again has kind of, I think that it's a stadium, it's the main stadium of Paraguay. It's actually a national stadium. It doesn't really belong to any of the clubs. I mean, for me, it's like one of those most imposing of stadiums in the continent, because it is the defenders of the Chaco. It harks back to this Paraguayan idea of defending our strongholds. This is where our heroes come. And, you know, I think we talked about a little bit in terms of the CONMEBOL qualifying. There is nothing harder than going to play in that stadium. You know, certainly a lot of Colombian teams have come a horrible cropper in more ways than one at that particular pitch. And again, when Olimpia are playing in Cerro Porteño, they will normally play their games at the Defensores del Chaco just to get those crowds in. And you know that you can imagine what the atmosphere is like. You've got, you know, 120 minutes of jumping around, because they won't start at the starting whistle. They'd have started 15 minutes before that. They'll go through the halftime interval. They'll probably jump around 15 or 20 minutes after that. Then they'll suddenly realise that the game's finished. The referee, you know, has headed off and they can't throw anything anymore. So then they'll probably finish and go home. You don't quite see the same amount of numbers at the other derbies. There's actually a bit of a tradition of leaving Asunción on the weekends and going to the country to fish or to go to your fincas or having a little bit of space. So some of those other derbies don't quite have the same amount of importance or impact or atmosphere as the big Cerro Porteño Olimpia derby.
It's fascinating, you know, and listening to what you're sort of, you know, what you're saying there, Pete. Because my question was just about to be to Gary, but I'm still going to ask it anyway. But I have now just checked myself based on that last sentence. And I was going to say about how important derbies are to football fans and to clubs and to cities and to the culture of football in certain countries, or even the culture of football in cities, you know, within individual cities. But I guess maybe not, based on what Pete's just answered there.
Yeah, I mean, a derby's a strange thing, isn't it? You know, we had, I think Chelsea's a great example, because Chelsea's local derby is Fulham. It has no real meaning, because Fulham have never really been, certainly in my lifetime that I can remember, have been anything like a rival to Chelsea in so many ways. And, you know, for much of the last, I don't know, 30, 40 years, the same has been true with Everton compared to Liverpool. And I think it needs to be a derby of almost equals for it to have any real menace. And I think that's why, you know, perhaps one of the reasons why Olimpia and Cerro Porteño derby is perhaps the most important derby, because they are, you know, perhaps the two strongest teams in Asunción. And, you know, in Barcelona, you know, the Barcelona derby with Espanyol doesn't really mean that much to Barcelona fans. Their derby is the Real Madrid, the Clásico. Perhaps, you know, one where there is a strong derby of equals I can think of is El Gran Derby, which is in Seville, between Sevilla and Betis. That is a derby that means something. It's in the same city, and it's a derby of, you know, approximate equals. So yeah, it's interesting to hear Pete say there's so many derbies that have names in Asunción, and I suppose it's almost got that historical context, because perhaps it doesn't have the rivalry context or the full meaning. You know, if a team is sort of, you know, is playing, you know, a team who's third playing, I don't know, clubs in the league, third playing a team who's regularly 17th, it's not going to be that much of a heated derby, perhaps. But, you know, I guess, you know, derbies will always have local pride at stake. But when you've got, you know, such a concentration of clubs in one city, I guess inevitably it must be diluted unless there's that rivalry of equals between them. I don't think, is that right? Do you think that's a bit right, Pete?
Yeah, no, I think you're right, Gary. I think that because I can't remember, it's seven teams are in Asunción this season in the Premier League. You know, it's a small league anyway. You know, there's a couple of teams from Luque. There's, I think, Guaireña from the rural areas of Paraguay are in the league this season. But I think because that there are so many games that are just another game against a team from Asunción, it doesn't quite have that impact. I mean, I think there will be the hardened supporters who obviously will care massively. And, you know, when, I don't know, Guaraní are playing River Plate, because there is a River Plate team in Asunción as well. We haven't mentioned them. They're not as big as the other River Plate, the famous one, but they are there. You know, I think the people that will care, and they'll probably find a reason to hate them and turn up and bang that drum. But, you know, it's not quite the same. I think it has to be deleted a little bit just because, you know, every game is against a team that probably plays within 30 kilometres, 40 kilometres. So, yeah, you're probably right.
Stephen, you know, the South American derbies, we have this almost this romantic sort of image of the South American derby. You know, and as Pete was saying, you know, certainly, you know, one particular derby in Asunción sort of lives up to those stereotypes, but you'd like to think that every game that is a derby in South America, is played out in that environment, you know, whether it's stereotypical or, you know, whether it's actually factual. But there's a part of, I think, every football fan that just wants to believe that every rivalry in South America is just the single most important event of the year. And it's, you know, it's an event that lasts about 3 days and, you know, and all those things that go with it. It's how you want your South American derbies to be.
It is. It's like the classic Christmas card. So there's always snow on the front of a Christmas card. Yeah, it very rarely snows at Christmas. You know, you could look at, say, a city like Madrid. We'll go back to Madrid. You know, you've got Real Madrid, you've got Atletico, you know, Rayo Vallecano, Getafe. You know, so, you know, Getafe are never really going to mean that much to a Real Madrid. You know, so there's that dilution as the further you go, which is a shame because, you know, those games will mean so much to the smaller club. But the chance to, you know, take the prize is absolutely massive. So yes, you know, even if it's an unrequited rivalry, there's still that edge there, and it will mean something to someone. But yes, you know, for the biggest of clubs, they'll keep their powder dry for the biggest rivals.
It's, I mean, like I said, I knew this series would be great right from the start. And I guess, you know, one sort of, I suppose, obvious question, or the last obvious question, Pete, and that's, you know, famous coaches, famous players that have, you know, that have come from Asunción, you know, that, you know, not necessarily, you know, in contemporary terms, but certainly, you know, players throughout the history of the game, you know, in that city, footballers and coaches who have hailed from that city or have made a name for themselves in that city.
Yeah, I think what's interesting about Paraguay is that a lot of Paraguayan footballers, like the best Paraguayan footballers, in lots of ways haven't achieved a lot of their greatest success in Paraguay. You know, they've started there, but then they've gone elsewhere. I mean, the best example of that is Arsenio Errico, you know, the greatest Paraguayan player of all time, arguably. We talked about him I think I picked him as my greatest Paraguayan in that series. You know, he scored 300 goals in the Argentinian League for Independiente. You know, barely played in Paraguay throughout his career. I think also there are a couple of players, you know, if we you know, pick a few people that people might not have heard of, that, like Manuel Fleitas Solich, who was known as the Witch. You know, he did extremely well playing for Nacional in Paraguay. He then went on to play for Boca Juniors in the 1930s, which, you know, again, a Paraguayan having success in the Argentinian League, carried the same amount of success. But then he went on to be a very important manager around the whole continent. He coached Real Madrid briefly. He coached Palmeiras, Flamengo, Fluminense. He was the coach of the Paraguayan team the first time they won the Copa America. We look at Cayetano Rey, another you know, player who's often forgotten, but this was a guy that played in Spain for Elche and then Barcelona and was Pichichi. He was the leading scorer in the Spanish league in the 1964-5 season, somewhere around there. So there are lots of players like that. I mean, Asuncion, obviously, it's the main city. A lot of the greatest players, you know, have come from there. It's worth remembering the likes of, you know, Salvador Cabanas. There's a great story about him. He was a striker that was, you know, going to be the next great Paraguayan striker and was playing in Mexico. And then, you know, survived an assassination attempt, you know, got shot in the head, somehow survived. Didn't play in the 2010 World Cup, but still, you know, 16 months later, you know, ended up playing a tribute game. You know, one of the guys that probably could have made it and been an next great Paraguayan footballer. So there are lots of these kind of players, but interestingly, a lot of them have their major successes outside, you know, outside Paraguay. I mean, it's really interesting looking back to some of the triumphs of Olympia, you know, in 79 and in the, you know, the 1990s, and the 1989, 1991. You look at those teams and you don't really recognise many of the players. You don't really pick these household names like you do for Santos or some of the Argentinian clubs where you think, oh yeah, that was when X was playing there or Y was playing there and that was that great generation. You know, somehow Paraguay doesn't have that. I mean, you know, I'm going to try and force this story in because we haven't managed to get it in, but we're kind of coming to the last chance. But I mean, one of the great heroes of Paraguayan football is an Orange. In the 1979, you know, in the final versus Boca Juniors at the home leg, there's a long-range free kick. Olympia have already scored an early goal, but there's a long-range free kick that's kind of trickling pathetically towards the goal, and the Argentine keeper is kind of lining up confidently, you know, looking to gather it in his arms. And then it suddenly bobbles and goes over the goalie's shoulder into a net. And it turns out that it hit an Orange that had been probably lobbed at the goalkeeper by some vagrant in the stands. And the ball had actually hit this Orange, bounced over the goalkeeper and gone in. So, I mean, you know, I think the great Orange of Asuncion probably has as much claim to be one of the great moments of Paraguayan football as some of these other players that we've mentioned.
I can't wait to hear of the Apple of Rio and everything else we're going to have going on.
Pineapple of Peru.
Yeah, there you go. You know, I suppose, you know, again, Gary, it's, you know, it's fascinating here. You know, you have this high concentration of clubs, and you know, it's something that's been, you know, that's been a narrative right throughout this episode. And you know, this high concentration of clubs and this sort of expectation, like we say, that, you know, the great and the good of Paraguayan football will hail from there and they'll make their name there and they'll do well there. But you know, and again, as Pete says, it's not always necessarily the case that greatness is achieved where it's born. You know, people have to move away in order to achieve that greatness.
Yeah, Viva Dolania, by the way. But yeah, one of the guys I sort of looked up was Carlos Gamarra, who comes from Asuncion, but he sort of had success in Europe with Benfica. He played for Inter Milan, and then his career took him as well to Brazil, China, Spain, Mexico, Argentina, and Chile. You know, and he won a couple of titles with Cerro Porteño, I think. But his most sort of famous success is the big part of his career was spent abroad. And you know, it seems strange that I guess what happens is you know, there's such a celebration of Argentine Brazilian footballers who, you know, go to Europe, big European clubs, but sometimes, you know, the players from lesser known South American countries like Paraguay often get lost in the shadows. But yeah, there's been some stars, as Pete's mentioned, and I say, you know, Gamarra was certainly one of them.
You know, again, you know, Stephen, it's a quirk of, and I guess it's why, you know, it's why we love the game as well. But this, you know, you sort of, you know, you associate, you know, this is certainly, I can't speak for you guys, but certainly for myself, you know, you associate that sort of South America, everybody plays it everywhere. It's just like it is in the UK or Europe. There's you know, there's hundreds of teams, there's great players on every corner. It's, you know, or it's the traditional stories of poverty and players making good. And, you know, you just assume that there's almost this production line of talented, skillful, slightly sleight of hand or underhand South American footballers that are just constantly churned out. And then you come to, you know, first episode one, you know, and you sort of all of a sudden the story is so much different to how you perceive it to be.
Yeah, there's no stereotype to Paraguay. And that's the thing that floods through for me. I think we mentioned it when we did them in the Nations series about how the Paraguayans, everything that they achieve, they've got to fight for and work for. You know, the workers rather than artists, you know, for me, you know, the fighters. Probably no more so than there was a game, a youth cup game, and it was Sportivo Emiliano made the Guinness Book of Records. An amazing 20 red cards were brandished in a game against the wonderfully named General Caballero.
That's the guy who started the Guarani club.
Yeah.
The Guarani, it's named after him. Yeah.
It's absolutely spectacular. It was great because I tripped across the story and it was kind of like, yeah, you know, fight broke out between two players. It lasted for about 7-8 minutes and then it all kicked off and the referee had sent off the two. And then it kicked off for 7 or 8 minutes and once it quelled down, he sent off all but two other players. It was, yeah. And it's in the Guinness Book of Records and nothing. You know, can say that Paraguay are a nation of fighters and battlers more than having 20 red cards and making the Guinness Book of Records.
I mean, again, you know, we like to have a sort of a question at the end of this, and we've got one for this series, and it's not my question. I wasn't the one who came up with this question, but it is a question that you are all going to be asked, and I think it's a very fair question to finish with. It wasn't Gary or Pete who came up with the question either, so I'm just putting that out there. But if you were airdropped into Asunción, whether it was through work or whether it was through marriage, it can be however you want, but ultimately you're being airdropped in there and that's where you are going to live from now. Which side are you supporting? Gary, you're the one who's made the transition abroad, so I'm going to start with you. You should be able to answer this one easier than everyone else.
It's a really good question. I knew it was coming last time. I was dicing my mind between two, and you know, I don't want to give two answers, but
I do, Gary.
Yeah, no, but I'm going to resist the temptation, so I'm going to go for Libertad. Is that right?
Yes.
Libertad. Is that the pronunciation, Pete?
Libertad.
Libertad. Yeah.
You're supporting the dictators team, then. That was Stresner's team.
Oh no! Well, forget that.
To be fair, Gary, you couldn't say that. It's going to take you a while to let us know who you're supporting.
Well, I'm going to give somebody else in there because I can't even say it. So I'm going to go for Resistencia because I think that's a great story that's being told about the grounds, the wanted by property developers, and it keeps getting flooded, but they bail it out. So I'd like to go along and help. Bail out the ground for Resistencia.
And it's easier for you to say by the sound of it as well.
I'm learning Spanish and I can't even say that.
Brilliant. I can't wait for next week.
Active a role in the singing of the songs at the struggling to keep up.
You just keep the beat, Gary, that you can be the beat behind the songs. Pete, for you, who would you be supporting?
Yeah, I mean, hugely tempted as I am by Presidente Hayes, I kind of want to go and have a look at some of the Primera Liga games. You know, I think that's kind of a little bit interesting. So I think I'm going to go with Guarani. I'm fascinated by a team that takes its identity and takes its name from an indigenous identity. I think that's really interesting. You know, I think that some of their club stories, their legends, you know, again, resonate with what I'm interested about football. you know, they've got a fair degree of success. And as a Southampton fan, I wouldn't mind just a little bit of a chance to win something every now and again. So, you know, so it's a very tiny step towards glory hunting, I think. You know, and again, the chance to have a couple of Copa Libertadores evenings seems quite fun as well. So yeah, I think I'd be heading along in the black and gold of Guarani.
Oh, nice colours. I think I would have picked them based just on colour. Stephen, for you, obviously, you know, I guess, you know, this is your question, so you definitely need to be prepared for this answer.
Well, I'm happily going along for a game with both Gary and Pete there for their respective games, most definitely. But yeah, no, I'm, and we discussed them at the start of the podcast, well, whether they actually counted as being in Asuncion or not. But Solder America are quite fascinated. You know, only a couple of titles to the name. You know, they were managed by Frenet Puskás. You know, I'd just want to know a bit more about that. You know, Puskás is same as Di Stefano, because there were such iconic players. No one really gives them the credit for the managerial skills. You know, Puskás took Panathinaikos to the European Cup final in 71, and then goes to Paraguay and wins a league title for an unfashionable club. I know, even just to be on a fact-finding mission, I think, I'd be off to watch Soldo America.
Excellent. And obviously you will all, I guess, now have multiple Dick Dastardly games to look forward to in your newfound place of residence. Guys, it's like I say, it's been brilliant. I always say it, and I always feel like I have the best job, and I absolutely do have the best job on these series. It's great to listen to the three of you just chat, and obviously Pete, the wealth of knowledge is just incredible, and we're only on one of 14. It's been a brilliant start. Gary, happy with it?
Oh, delighted, mate. I mean, you know, we've looked at Asuncion as perhaps one of the lesser known, and potentially sort of, you know, well, there's not that much to talk about, and here we are, sort of, I don't know, an hour and
I want a quarter, yeah.
Later. And, you know, and we could have gone on for much longer, because when you've got somebody with the knowledge that the Pete's got, you know, it's every day's a school day and it's enjoyable as well. Welcome back to school, guys.
Yeah, it's been a great first day back. Just no homework, Pete, because it's the first day back. Just go easy on the first day.
I'll practice my pronunciation more than a while.
Yeah, to be fair, actually, Gary, yes, you have got a homework. Stephen, enjoyed it?
Oh, had a ball, an absolute ball. Always do when we've got Pete on, and it's just you learn so much, and yeah, just a proper eye-opening kind of podcast yet again.
And Pete, obviously, like I say, it's you never ever fail to deliver. You never disappoint. It's just been another brilliant sort of hour and a quarter spent in Asuncion in Paraguay, and I didn't think I'd be saying that when I first went to work this morning about our fateful of trepidation. It's not how I thought my day would be ending, but it's been brilliant, absolutely brilliant.
No, always a pleasure. I mean, it's one of those, I think we talked about when we did the country series, that Paraguay is one of the countries that's had the least amount of stuff written about it in South America. You know, in Paraguay there've been a couple of books, but you know, from my academic perspective, that you just don't find a huge amount of journal articles or books written about why football matters. And, you know, there's probably a lot in that. I mean, we've talked a lot about identities and stuff today, you know, and where clubs come from, the names of clubs and how the war matters. So, yeah, I mean, there's a lot to be said. And, you know, I think I learned a lot just kind of, you know, brushing up my knowledge of Paraguay as I was preparing for this as well. So, you know, we're all learned a lot. So it's always good to hear from Gary and Steve as well, and get their opinions. So, no, good fun.
Brilliant. And Gary, one last question for you. Where are we heading next?
Heading to Argentina, and we're going to go to the city that has the same name as the street on the other side of this wall here, which is Avellaneda. Calle Avellaneda is where I live, and so we're going to that city next.
Brilliant. Brilliant. Like I say, all that's left for me to say, you know, sort of certainly to you guys, is thank you once again for an incredible hour and a quarter for me just listening and asking questions as per usual about what I'm particularly interested in what I want to know about. Stephen, I don't think I'll ever think about South American football without thinking about Wacky Races, or I'll never watch an episode of Wacky Races without thinking about football. One or the other.
I think when Lewis asked the question, is there anything I can put on to the start of this podcast? And yes, Lewis, I think it's going to need to be the theme tune to the Wacky Races.
I think it may just well be. What a great idea for every episode. I shall look forward to that. In fact, I'll just add the Dick Dastardly section into our suggested topic.
I need to have like the most Wacky Races moment of football.
All that's left for me to say is, well, if you want to watch Wacky Races or listen to Wacky Races or listen about South American football in its various cities, please join us again next time on the Lob Podcast with These Football Times. Thank you and goodbye.
Many thanks for joining us today on The Lob, a These Football Times production. For more of our content, check out our award-winning print magazine featuring some of the game's foremost writers, artists and photographers, exploring areas of the game rarely covered in high-end print. For now, we look forward to you joining us again soon.